And so it's really about understanding that you have the potential and therefore the hope to re-engineer the pathways in your brain to all that full massive potential you had on the day that you were born, before anybody started telling you that you couldn't do something or you shouldn't do something. So authentic self is really just the best self that you can be.
Welcome to the Expanded Podcast with your host, Lacey Phillips. As a leading manifestation advisor with a process that's, well, radically different from the old New Age model, mine is rooted in psychology, neuroscience, and my energetic gifts. I created this podcast to help you expand your subconscious limiting beliefs about the potential of deserving the manifestations you're calling in. Therefore, you're tuning into this podcast series to show your subconscious that anything you desire is possible. And by pressing play, you've already started the process of manifesting it. I hope you're having a wonderful week. We're out of Mercury retrograde. Well, we're in the shadow phase, which I always kind of comment on. That's what affects me much more than actual Mercury retrograding. I tend to be very prosperous and calm and happy during that time, in fact. Whereas Max is a double Virgo, which is obviously ruled by Mercury. It's just nuts what happens to him. So I know we're all affected very differently based on how it's hitting our chart. But I did want to touch on something this week. I was scrolling through our new community portal that we launched for the Pathway members. I mentioned it last week. I was scrolling through and I was reading, and I kept seeing that people were only manifesting small things. And I know that this is just a generalization. Many people out there are actually manifesting great big things. I see those in our DMs and I also see it in there, but I was seeing a pattern. So I wanted to address that and just give a tool. As many of you know, my gift is reading energetics. And what I became really good at was starting to understand like the beautiful energetic points that needed to be hit to manifest. And this is actually a really good one. So one thing I want to talk about is understanding how to project your personal authentic power. And when I use the word power, there can be a lot of negativity that's associated with that word. I'm not talking about toxic power. I'm talking about empowered, which is very different because it's very authentic. In fact, we'll have her on here soon, but I tend to do little hikes with my astrologer in the mornings during the week, Dani Beinstein. And we talked about that. And she said, wow, Lacey, one thing that's so crazy about you is you're not really in touch with just the darker side of humanity as humans that we can get into. And she was like, when you manifest money or want, you know, money, and luxury is one of my authentic words of my code, she's like, it just means freedom for you. And I'm like, yeah. So that's just a little point I want to make on empowered versus toxic power. So when I'm saying power, you know, what is your version of empowered? It's different for everybody, but I digress. The thing I actually want you to focus on is an old manifestation teaching. I call it rhetoric sometimes, that New Age rhetoric, the spiritual bypass version of manifestation. One practice that I remember practicing would be to visualize in my conscious state without having addressed anything in my subconscious state, and also pretending to be or pretending to have what I want and what I'm calling in. I always remember this classic example that I read in a book where it was like, if you're calling in a partner on the bedside next to you, pretend as if they're already there. So place a pillow for them, or in your closet, make space for them, drawers, make space for them. And I tried all those things, right? And having the gift of reading energetics, that's actually not very powerful. It has a little bit of energetic pull, but very, very minimal. One thing I want people to get in the habit of, especially with such a wild year astrologically, as a collective, we faced a massive natural disaster. We faced a pandemic. We've unveiled massive injustice. And, you know, a lot of us can be pretty off kilter right now. And when you hear in spirituality, find your center, in manifestation, it's very similar. Find your personal power, your empowered state of power, not toxic power. And so I like to take abstract energetics and make them actionable and something we can wrap our heads around. So that old practice where it's like pretend to have or pretend to be or act as if or visualize, in fact, something that has way more energetic pull is to get back into your empowered state and kind of project it, fill your aura with it. So a good way to figure out your personal power is starting with figuring out your authentic code. We have that inside the pathway. It's a standalone now, so you don't have to go through any of the up-level workshops. You can just simply go there, find out what your four words are. It kind of gives you direction of like delegate or get rid of anything that isn't it, but it'll give you an idea. And you can also do this in meditation where you can really just feel into your authentic self. Another way in would be inside of the daily reprogramming exercise. We have the 1DI that's called your magnetic self, your authentic self. Doing that will give you a glimpse of it. So really, really touching into your authentic code or what you see in that deep imagining, that personal power. And if you sit with yourself with your eyes closed and you just feel into it, it's nothing that you have to do or pretend to be or fake. It's none of that. None of those things in manifestation work. It's actually feeling into your true authenticity and what makes you so special. And again, it's not a toxic version or an ego version. It's the beauty of you inside, your actual energy. And even as I'm speaking, many of you can feel into this now. A great visual too is if you bring to mind your 6-month-old self, you know, and how you were still so pure and bright and loving and genuine. Not that those are going to be the words of people's individual power, their empowered self, but it'll help you get a visual and energy. And when you're in that space, or actually another way, even I'm giving you a lot of options to figure out how to touch in with this energy if it seems abstract, anytime you pass a test that's resulted in a manifestation, that energy you feel after the test. Again, it's not ego. It's not a toxic, empowered state. It's actually just finally being in your worth, your power, knowing your beauty, knowing how special you are, finding your center. That, if you want to play with that energy and project your aura with it, so say you're doing a DI in the morning, or say you're getting ready in the morning, starting to play into that energy and just taking a moment to fill your aura or fill yourself up with that. And it's called projecting it. That is a better way to approach the acting as if, or the pretending as if, or whatever, the visualizing. Actually learning how to play with your energy is so incredibly powerful. And it's also something really tangible. I would love to hear Dr. Tara's take on this, that you can play with when you're in a moment where you have to set a boundary, or you have to have a hard conversation, or you have to pass a test, or you simply are maybe anxious and ungrounded, how you can get back into that place. And even when you're doing a deep imagining, you'll hear me mention a practice I've been doing based on something that Dr. Tara mentioned, that I got into understanding my kind of coda dog paddling self. When I was down there reprogramming it in my subconscious, I gave myself a new conscious reinforcement, which is I am secure. And so I understand now, because I've gotten into that subconscious place, because I've seen what that looks and feels like and the difference of it, and I've now taken that exact concept all the way through inner child again, reparenting myself to be secure in every stage of my life. When I'm in the conscious state and I'm feeling that wavering anxiousness or ungroundedness, or what if they don't like me, or this, that, or the dog paddling, I can easily use that conscious reinforcement, that saying, I am secure, and feel it. So it helps me sink in to my personal power. And then I fill myself up with that. I project into my aura, I project from that place. That has a far quicker magnetic pull than any of the pretend to be, the visualize, the et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's just a concept I really want to give you to play with. And I guess what I'm also giving you is a deeper licensing, however you're showing up in the world right now, in whatever way that we are all being affected so uniquely, what we all have the power to do, because it's just energy. It requires no physical money, but nothing. It just requires us really tapping into getting back to our authentic personal power and using it to get centered and project. And I give you that licensing because if you are only manifesting the small things right now, little things are coming through, or maybe you feel like your role has stopped, you've really got to look and see if you're fragmented right now, meaning that your personal power is all over the place, or it's not all connected and centered and projecting just based on all of the trauma that's been taken in and all of the ways we've been affected. I really invite everybody in this community to take a look at your personal power and really work with it to center and project it, because from that place, you can actually show up and make a difference. You can actually be a vision holder. You can be an expander. You can be an activist. You can be a healer. You can be an artist. You can be all of the reasons why you've divinely been put on this earth to show up and to make an impact and or impact yourself. Also, Jessica and I are going to be recording our anniversary episode. It was a smash hit last year. So what that episode is going to consist of is you can ask me anything personally and Jessica anything personally, not manifestation based, because we have supported for that and we share so much information on that. But this is just to get a deeper connection with any questions you've had about stuff I've been up to, me, who I am. I didn't ask me anything on Instagram last week, which I pulled because there were so many overwhelming questions I couldn't get to. And I asked, would you like to hear this on an episode? And it was a resounding 97% yes. So go ahead and tune in on Monday. We will be putting that poll up where you can throw in any questions you've been having that you want to know more about. And then that brings me into today's episode. I am so excited for today's episode. You will be too. I think our last episode with Dr. Tara Swart has now definitely become a favorite. We keep hearing about it, and we're so grateful to everybody who's reached out that's so excited for this collaboration. We certainly are. We have Dr. Tara Swart back today. She's our in-house neuroscience and psychology advisor that we've partnered with, who is going through the workshops to make them even more scientifically anchored and practices that are even more effective. She also joins us once a month on the Explain podcast now so that we can really combine energetics, psychology, and neuroscience. And we're so excited to be weighing in deeper today with what is considered our basics bundle, which is how to manifest, shadow work, and inner child. Let's get in deep with Jessica moderating between myself and Dr. Tara Swart about the basics of this process. All right, let's get into today's episode.
Welcome back, guys, to another episode of Explained. We are so excited to be joined by Dr. Tara Swart on this new format of Explained, where Lacey's going to kind of be our expert in manifestation and energetics, and Dr. Tara is going to be our neuroscientist and psychology expert. Welcome, everyone.
Thank you. Welcome to you. I have one question for you before we kick off. So I kind of go through this cycle, you know, one night a week. It's just sort of kind of how my channeling works, where I won't sleep well. Usually I'm woken up at like 3 a.m. and I start channeling all this stuff. And then my brain the next day is just kind of mushy. What does that do? I mean, we know, obviously, we've read like a lot of health things, but in the brain, for instance, even like, let's say, approaching your manifestation process or just whatever's going on in life right now, like, how does that work against you? And are there any quick tips, like me in this particular instance, that can put you right back on track again?
I mean, if it's just one night and then you usually go back to your normal pattern from then on for at least several nights, it won't be causing any issues at all, really. So you can make up for one lost night's sleep by sleeping well the following night. But if it gets to four or five nights in a row, then it can start to cause some problems. And it kind of depends where in the sleep cycle it's been disrupted, which obviously you don't always know, but it can have effects on different types of memories and things like that. But I would say, you know, it's very interesting with channeling and energetics. You could argue that it's the brain state is another form of dreaming. And dreaming is actually very good for us, and it's part of emotional processing. So you're a trickier person to say whether it's a good thing, but it's certainly not a bad thing. That's what I would say.
I love that. And I'm going to kick it over to you in 1 second, Jessica, but this brought another tangent. Many of our members I've seen in the past, they'll be like, during the deep imaginings, the hypnosis, they're like, I'm not getting anything, nothing's coming up, but they're very big dreamers. Like their dreams, their subconscious is sort of working itself out, or unconscious, you know, I'll let you clarify that. And they're having these really powerful experiences in their dreams where they're kind of sometimes doing their own DIs and healing their own blocks and programming. Will you speak to that for a minute?
100%, because it's not immediate for everybody. And so the experience that I've had, so with the DIs, I feel definitely like I'm very submerged in it. But funnily enough, I've had a few of your followers message me on Instagram and say, but I don't get to the subconscious stage. And so I've just sort of written back and said, you know, we're working on like helping you with that, but just try to surrender to it. So even though I'm the scientist, I do believe you can't fight it. And I think some people fight it because they're frightened, or, you know, like people who feel very uncomfortable at doing meditation. But my experience, like what these particular people describe, is when I do flotation tank and people say, oh, you sleep so well that night and like you have immediate insights. That doesn't happen to me. I have absolutely nothing until the next night.
Wow.
And then just as I'm falling asleep, it feels like everything I've been working on for ages, like in all different modalities, that falls into place.
Wow.
Yeah. So I think that whether it's delayed or not is just probably to do with how you process memory, how you process emotion, you know, whether you're a reflective person rather than a sort of instant insight person. Normally I would say reflective. And I think, you know, that Nikki and Grace have kind of noticed that in the way that I'm going over and over and over again all the materials and then leaving some days and then going over them again. Because that's how I, you know, I wake up in the middle of the night with ideas, like some of the ones I've mentioned to Jessica. So I think everything in science is based on population norm studies, which is the majority of people. But of course, there are always outliers. So we can definitely say there's a smaller number of people that only get the effects later. And that may be in your dreaming. It may be when you're in the bath. It may be when you're falling asleep or waking up. So that's completely normal.
So there's hope, because everybody's essentially different, you know, or they're, like you're saying, outliers. I like that. Oh, there's so many more questions I have, but I'm going to kick it to Jessica. I'm like, what about microdosing in the tank? Like, what does that do to your brain?
Like,
I was here like, people, you know, even my partner shares with me that Joe Rogan does that. But anyways, we'll save that for another conversation. Jessica, it's all you.
Okay. So today's episode theme is we're going back to really the foundation of manifestation. And the foundation is how to manifest inner child and shadow. And so with that, that's kind of like the core tools that we think when you're jumping into this work that are really necessary to shake up the subconscious, to move through some of the blocks and really to learn the process and integrate some of the terminology and start to see that patterning in your life. So in Explained, we always kick it off with a quote. And so here's our quote for this week. Manifestation is calling in and receiving whatever it is that you want in life. We manifest from our deep-rooted subconscious beliefs, as the universe's entire intention is for us to grow into our most whole, worthy, authentic selves. So let's kind of break the process down, the To Be Magnetic manifestation, Lacey Phillips process. It really comes down to psychology, neuroscience, and energetics. Why is there such a overlap of connection between all of these things? Because I think in the past, manifestation has felt very maybe esoteric and sort of woo-woo and out there and spiritual, but you can't really make it tangible. And I think adding the elements of psychology and neuroscience really kind of bring it down into like a rooted understanding of what's going on. So let's just talk on the intersections of all of these sort of modalities and how it relates to manifestation.
I'll kind of kick it off and then I'll hand it over, because I actually have a question right off the bat. So what I really noticed for myself, and I think many listeners who have been following for a while also, you know, have heard me say this many times, but I practiced a lot of that old new age manifestation rhetoric. Little things would come through, but it was never until I truly understood that I needed to step into my worth and deservingness. And the way that I approached doing that was having to address anything I picked up in life through shame, pain, and programming that made me feel unworthy of the things that I wanted that were still holding me back. And then through the process, when I really started to manifest and I started to pull off these onion layers, I realized, wow, whoa, I would keep getting these glimpses of my true self, my higher self, my authentic self, whatever we want to call it. And I was like, that's who I am inside, but it's not who I'm behaving. And then I started to discover what would become shadow work, though I was already doing a version of that beforehand. You know, and I started to realize anytime I integrated more, I became more magnetic. And then, of course, the energetics I could read, and it was like playing a video game, you know, that you needed to expand and you needed to pass these tests and all of that stuff. But this leads me to kind of want to kick off to you, Dr. Tara, the authentic self. I talk about this a lot, the higher self, our true self. You know, when you were going through school and you were doing your research, what would you call that scientifically?
Yeah, I think it's so interesting that many people would say that energetics is at one end of the spectrum and neuroscience is at the other. And, you know, perhaps that psychology and psychotherapy is closer to neuroscience, but it's still on the spectrum. Whereas everything that you've just said rings completely true to me from the neuroscience research. And so there are psychotherapeutic terms like ego and id and superego, but there isn't necessarily a word for it in neuroscience, but it's all about potential. And as you and I have discussed before, it's about the hope that neuroplasticity gives us. And so it starts off with this idea that our thoughts are more sort of what we call supraconscious. So they're above our level of consciousness and awareness. And our beliefs are more subconscious, but they're intertwined so strongly that you can't separate them. So however much you say, I want to achieve that or I deserve this. If you don't believe it in your subconscious, then there's a misalignment and it can't happen. And you're absolutely right that those sorts of beliefs of not deserving usually come from some sort of childhood trauma or humiliation or shame. And so it's really about understanding that you have the potential and therefore the hope to re-engineer the pathways in your brain to all that full massive potential you had on the day that you were born before anybody started telling you that you couldn't do something or you shouldn't do something. So authentic self is really just the best self that you can be by achieving the potential of your neurons. And the field of epigenetics comes in really strongly here because we always thought, like we thought, that your brain sort of stopped growing at the age of 18 and then you were stuck with what you have, that you were born with the genes that you inherited from your parents, that you can't go against DNA. And the nature and nurture debate has gone sort of, you know, swung sort of either way. But now with epigenetics, which is the effect of the environment, the influence of the environment on your genes, it means that certain behaviors and certain thought patterns, which are obviously backed up by subconscious beliefs, can actually switch on and off the expression of certain genes. So things like how long you might live, how likely you are to stay married, how likely you are to become obese, and all sorts of other things are actually much more within your control than we thought before. So I think that so massively backs up all of, you know, everything that you say from an energetics point of view.
I have a question to segue into this a little bit based on what you said. I believe, and I think this is scientifically backed up now, even through epigenetics, that everything that we are reacting to, and like even in this work, right? When I'm looking at it through an energetic lens, it's like we are dancing with our environment, essentially. And I actually, when I think of the universe, I don't think of a man or, you know, whatever that depiction of God or whatever. I think of it as everything around us, right? You know, consciousness and everything in connection. So I perceive that when I'm dealing with energetics and trying to anchor them down into tangible reality, essentially what I'm getting at is what we're perceiving from our environment, we are reacting to. That's what we're dancing with. And so it's really interesting that you touch on the epigenetics portion, which, you know, is so strongly tied into everything else. I saw a comment we got recently in Instagram where it was like, you have these members who aren't truly integrating and aren't consciously communicating. They're just like passing tests and trying to be in their worth and walking away from things, but they're not actually doing it from an integral, integrated place. And I'm like, yeah, but that's part of their process. You know, the more we integrate, it's kind of like walking upstairs and stepping stones. So really what we're doing is we're, I believe, dancing with our environment, which is so hopeful as well, based on what you're saying. You know, I'm kind of making this lofty, but something that I just really want to hammer home here and anchor down is that dealing with manifestation energetics, we're really just engaging and dancing with whatever we're perceiving to be real, whether that's a test coming at us, so an opportunity of maybe a suitor that shows old low self-worth patterning, and we have to say no, and we have to therefore hold out for the next best thing to come through while we're doing this work and integrating further. So what would you say on that? I know I'm not really coming up with a full question here, but if you want to just add to it from, you know, more of a science perspective, that's essentially what we're doing when we're learning how to read energetics and play with them. It's dancing with our environment.
Yeah, I love that, you know, analogy or metaphor, as you'd like to call it. But the thing that stood out to me from the science point of view is our environment as we perceive it. Now, that is not set in stone. So how you perceive your environment is through all the filters that have been placed in front of your brain throughout your life. And so you can change, you know, the way what you perceive. So whether it's, you know, a thought about your own worth, like, oh, you know, that suit is never going to go for me, or whether it's something about how difficult you think it is to like climb the career ladder. If you can start by questioning that perception, then you may actually be in a different environment, or it's possible that you can place yourself in a different environment to the one that you thought you're in. So, you know, some things, some people would argue with this, but some things are a little bit more fixed than others, like you can feel the earth under your feet or just some of the physical things around us. But most of the other things that we perceive are perceived through our filters. It's not necessarily a fact. And one of the things, you know, that I say to people who struggle with the same sort of questions that you've raised from your listeners is ask yourself, is that really 100% true? And that's often the beginning of a really interesting conversation, because most of the time people can't really say that it is. So that's a good question to ask oneself even.
And I think just for everybody listening to take inventory of that, that our perception while doing this work continues to change. There's a point, you know, in my younger 20s when I first started, or mid-20s, that I had a whole different perspective of what the world was. And in fact, most of the time I was a victim in the world just when it came to finances and jobs and my career and everything. And when I started to integrate a little bit more, that's where I saw the hope and the empowerment that I was like, wait, my perception's changing and so is my reality. And not to say that I'm disqualifying anything that anybody's gone through. This was for me specific. And I'm just trying to impart hope that it's like stairs. When we step up one stair, our lens, like you're saying, shifts a little. And then therefore the world shifts around us. And I would say that stepping up the stairs is literally what we're doing through inner child and shadow. I literally feel like that's what we're doing. We're integrating. And each time we step up, our lens is shifting and therefore our reality is shifting. And, you know, how to manifest the workshop is just giving us the tools of how to dance with that reality.
Not everybody identifies with the victim mentality necessarily. So some people may be one step further up than that, and they may identify with the fact that they feel that life happens to them and they react to it, and not necessarily in a negative way, but that they don't have agency over a lot of the things in their life, but they react in time and they react quite well, and that's been fine. But the, you know, what I found with How to Manifest in Shadow is that it moves that lens even a step further to, I'm not going to wait for things to happen to me and only react to the things that happen. I'm going to make things happen. And I think that's a really empowering stage of it as well.
I fully agree.
So I think to break it down further for someone who's listening at home, who's kind of putting together all the pieces as we're talking, it seems kind of what I'm hearing too is that manifestation is we're interacting with the world around us as we perceive it through all of the filters and programming that life has put upon us. But through, you know, self-actualization and the inner work and uncovering some of these filters and removing them, we now can interact with the world around us differently and have more autonomy over how we interact and attract different things around our environment.
Wow, what a great summary.
Yeah, thank you.
I think, Lacey, that we must have explained it really well if Jessica could come up with a summary like that so quickly.
Exactly.
Yes, agreed. So I'm quickly interrupting this episode to invite you, if you're ready to start your manifestation journey, or if anything you've heard in our manifestation episodes has piqued your interest, to begin. We have a la carte workshops in everything from the basics bundle, which is what we recommend to everyone who starts. It's the formula that actually teaches you how to manifest, unblocked inner child, and unblocked shadow. We also have a la carte workshops on love and money. But the real gem is the Pathway membership because it encompasses every single workshop we have. It's a year-long membership with full access to the few a la carte offerings we have and exclusive workshops not available anywhere else, such as the daily practice, which is what everybody in the Pathway uses, hopefully at least 3 times a week to daily in order to truly create the new neural pathways that one needs in order to manifest, and houses the library of our deep imaginings, which is our unique hypnosis process that allows you to get into your subconscious and overwrite those old neural pathways, creating the new ones. You can use our special code EXPANDED, all caps, EXPANDED, to receive $20 off your first a la carte workshop purchase or $20 off your first month of the Pathway. Again, that's all caps, EXPANDED, EXPANDED. Okay, now back to the episode.
I think one hang up that people have with sort of this type of conversation, this type of work, is like, are you saying that I'm attracting abuse? Are you saying I'm attracting trauma? And we just want to put the disclaimer out there that there are systems of oppression, injustice, marginalization, abuse that is truly out of someone's control. So we are in no way suggesting that because of your filters or programming that you are attracting that type of stuff in.
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, I often meet with the sort of challenge that manifestation work is really for people who are, you know, in a privileged enough position to do it. And of course, that is true to a massive extent. But I still, you know, try to really positively empower people by saying, even in a really bad situation, there might be one or two little things that you can do to make your situation better. But I think it's so important to say what you said, because a lot of criticism of the previous manifestation work that was, you know, that sort of spread quite far, was that if good things happen to you, that's because you thought in the right way and had the right beliefs and did the right thing. But if bad things happen to you, that's because you didn't think in the right way. And I think we're very aligned on the fact that we don't support that way of thinking at all. So whether like massive things are out of people's control, things like the Holocaust, slavery, like really big things, or small things, not smaller, but individual things, whether it's domestic violence or, you know, an abusive parent, there's a level of control where it's out of that person's hands. But I think, unfortunately, things like that, especially in childhood, can often set people up to accept that more in their later life. So I think there's something about tolerating things that you don't have to, which is probably the level at which we're discussing it.
Yeah, and I love what you said as well about the old version of manifestation, or the old rhetoric, you know, where it's like, if you think negatively, you attract negative experiences, which therefore could be really horrific ones. And, you know, I think that that's so irresponsible and very problematic, because not only A, I realized that it's absolutely not true, but B, not true to the extent that it's being taught, but B, also it furthers shame and low self-worth and really staying in a stuck zone. But, you know, one thing that I kind of wanted to ask, because I know that when you were a psychiatrist, I think you were working primarily with children. Do I have that correct, Dr. Tara?
For 2 of the 7 years, I worked with children. Yeah.
When you would see really, really devastating cases and you would start to see healing around them, what did that look like for just to empower the person who may be in a situation, who may be listening and feel like utterly powerless and, you know, really defeated and experiencing all of the hardship and pain that comes with that, just to give expansion and hope and empowerment to people out there who may be in circumstances right now that are really, really, really challenging?
That's such a thoughtful question. There's a couple of things that come to my mind. So I learned some research whilst I was a young doctor and working with children at one point. At that point, I was working more with teenagers, that a child only needs one really positive adult role model in their life, and it doesn't have to be one of their parents. Now, as a psychiatrist, and obviously, you know, there are social workers and there are sort of sports club leaders and teachers and all sorts of other people out there, that made me feel more than anything else that I could make a real difference to someone's life by being that person. So I think that, you know, either be that person yourself, or if you're a child and, you know, your parents can't show up for you, then find someone that can. So find somebody who you'd like to be like when you grow up, or you just really aspire to, or you find they're really kind. So that's one good thing. And then the other thing that I found myself saying, you know, way too often, but to children that were in a situation that they couldn't, you know, get out of at the time, was things really change once you become 18. It's 18 in the UK, maybe 21. But, you know, when you're at an age that you're allowed to make decisions for yourself. And so, you know, that group of children that I was working with were maybe 14, 16. So it wasn't that long away. And so, you know, sometimes I did say, like, there's not much that is going to realistically change in the next 1, 2, or 3 years, but a lot will change when you're 18. Like, I promise you that. So those are the first few things that came into my mind, but I have seen some absolutely horrendous things that I can't even give you an answer to how somebody gets through that. But people seem to, and you know, one thing we know is that if the trauma isn't too overwhelming, that it can build an enormous amount of resilience in people. And often people who've experienced that kind of thing want to go into social work or medicine or nursing themselves later. So I think, you know, we're going to cover this a little bit later, but there is something about whether a childhood trauma leads you towards a vice or a virtue. And again, that's not always everybody's choice, but there's a lot of research that shows that there is some element of a choice in how you come out of a trauma like that.
And like flipping it a little bit, because I love essentially what you just said, even if you're a parent who might be in a really, really challenging situation with your child or children, I mean, you showed that there's so much hope in finding an expander for them and helping them find essentially an expander. May it be a lifestyle expander, a career expander, a family expander, like a dynamic of what they, you know, would love to have. What would be the flip side of that when you would work with, say, an adult who is in a really debilitating situation?
I mean, expanders are still possible, obviously. So finding somebody who's been through a situation like what you've been through and come out of it and become really successful or really, you know, happy, successful in whatever way, happy, healthy. Yeah, so I think mostly there's the reason that we have like group therapy and communities in mental health work is so that families and patients can share stories, both the struggles, but also the things that worked that helped to break these cycles of either continually becoming unwell or struggling with side effects or the social side effects of some of the things that happen. So I would say, obviously, finding the right kind of caregivers in terms of the nurses and the social workers to support through something like that, having real life expanders. And then, you know, I always think that working more holistically, realizing that things like your diet and your sleep and, you know, the habits that you have play a much larger effect on even mental illnesses. So there's a really interesting statistic that I found out recently, which is that if you did a map of America and you looked at where the highest populations of people who are diagnosed with schizophrenia live, And then you did another map of America of where the highest number of infections of Lyme disease occur, that those two maps are practically identical.
Wow.
Yeah, and there's some more stories like that, but I think mental health and mental illness has always been seen as kind of separate to physical health. And in the UK, sometimes, you know, there were asylums and then there were mental wards on physical hospitals, and then they were separated into separate buildings. And I know that in the US that it's been kept quite separate as well. But I always say, if you had a heart attack or a heart problem, most people would take their medication and try to like lose weight and be more active and eat more healthily. But when it's your brain, people don't really see mental health problems as a brain problem, but it's actually no different to having a heart problem. So I think destigmatizing mental health problems, and you do have to be careful with things like manifestation if you have a diagnosed mental health problem, but you know, using some of the fundamentals of feeling worthy, of feeling that you deserve to fight for yourself to get the right and the best medication and the best support, and whether it's for you or your child, and not succumb to the, well, you'll probably always have a life like this because you've grown up in traumatic circumstances, or you've got a mental illness, or whatever it is. I still think it comes down to worth and deserving.
Mm-hmm. I absolutely agree. And, you know, I may catch flack for this, but I think it's really important. I will always stand on the side of empowering and philosophizing optimism for anybody out there that they can have the life that they want, regardless of what one has experienced, because I will never, ever reflect back the side that you're a lost hope. Sorry. Like, and I just could never, ever do that and leave anybody behind. So I will say that I will always be here to stand on the side, hold the vision for everybody that it's possible, their level of happiness, their authentic worthiness, unique to them.
I would say exactly the same, even from such a different background, whether it's as a former psychiatrist or a neuroscientist or a coach, that I would always stand on that side as well.
Guys, you know, from my Penn State degree, I will also stand on that side. But yes, I completely, completely agree. And I think that's also kind of a good segue into a little bit more of why we suggest inner child as part of the foundation and understanding sort of the impact of how the brain operates. And you touched on this a little bit in the last episode, but how, you know, we thought the brain was sort of static after a certain age. And now we understand that learning a language, it may be a little bit slower. I believe you said after the age of 26, but it is still possible to change and it is still plastine and plastic and malleable. So what exactly, like what's going on in the brain for those formative years as it is developing? And how is going back and sort of unpacking sort of those development stages able to help you peel back some of those filters?
So you're absolutely right that, you know, obviously I'm a big champion of the fact that even after, you know, from 26 onwards, there's a lot of plasticity in the brain. And in fact, somebody who's 26 to 66 plus, who does a lot to learn and take on change, might have a brain that's more plastic than a teenager if they're not doing anything, although, you know, they're usually in high school, so they're usually learning quite a lot. But
can I interject 1 second really quickly? Because I think that's such a valid and valuable point for like everybody in our community and especially our wives. What are some of the tiny key things that contribute to, say, somebody in their 60s brain potentially being more malleable than even somebody in 27? What is that?
Well, so intense learning. So learning that takes you a lot of effort. So, you know, it feels difficult, but also that actually maybe when you're in, you know, in a lesson, I'll give you an example, but when you're in, like, say, an hour and a half of learning the thing that you're focusing on, that you feel tired, you feel hungry, like it has to be that much of an effort. And so examples of that are learning a new language or learning a musical instrument or basically learning any new skill that you either haven't done before or you don't find easy. And so if throughout your life you kept doing things like that, you would, well, you'd absolutely build your resilience, because that learning doesn't just give you, I can now speak this language. it gives you what's called global benefits in the brain. And a lot of that is to do with resilience and ability to adapt to change. If somebody, you know, let's say you either didn't go to university or you finished university and then you just don't learn anything else and you hang out with the same people all the time and you don't have any variety in your routine, I would like to say that quite a few decades older, you could compete with somebody who's 27 that's never learning anything new by challenging your brain to learn new things. I mean, we know, for example, that the higher your educational level and the more learning you take on through life, it can set back the onset of Alzheimer's by up to 5 years. So there's a lot of things like that. And so I try to do one major neuroplasticity project per year. So either a language, I've done a few languages. I was about to start a musical instrument, but then we went into lockdown, so I couldn't do it the way that I wanted to. But, you know, I started a history of art course this year. So I will purposely take on a new learning challenge almost on a yearly basis. And when I was learning Danish, which was the last language that I tried to learn, it was so difficult. And I remember having to take like unhealthy snacks into like the lesson with me because I knew that my brain would just say, like, feed me sugar now or I can't get through it. And the moment when I got through a lesson and she said, okay, we're done for today, and I realized that 90 minutes had just sped by, I thought, okay, I've actually like changed my brain because this is no longer difficult. So it's very exciting. Wow. Yeah.
That's huge. And so that's like even when they would say, start to take on new crossword puzzles or, but you're saying take it even further, like an actual new, you know, whatever that's incredibly challenging for you.
Yeah. I mean, crosswords and Sudoku, the research shows that they're not enough to change your brain. But if you're a numbers person and you start crosswords, or if you're a, you know, a wordsmith and you start Sudoku, that actually could be enough because it's out of your comfort zone. But if you've been doing crosswords all your life, then continuing to do them isn't going to give you the benefit that we've just talked about.
Okay, sorry for the segue. That was really fantastic.
Well, and it also sounds like variety seems to be something important, which I think most humans crave a certain level of variety as well. So that makes a lot of sense.
Well, I think we've really seen that in lockdown where, you know, there's been much less variety in our lives, that we need a balance between simplicity and variety, basically. So we need some routine, but we also need some things that are out of the routine and that keeps the brain healthiest. So I think it'd be really useful for people to reflect on how that lack of routine has changed maybe, you know, their sleep pattern or their memory or their motivation, because it's a very intact little experiment of the last 3 or 4 months.
Absolutely.
So I like to go by Erikson's stages of child psychosocial development.
And something for everybody to look forward to, Dr. Tara is revamping our inner child workshop with us currently. So can't wait to hear more.
I mean, it's very aligned to what you've already said, that sort of 0 to 14 is where a lot of change occurs. And it's basically the earlier this has happened, the thicker the neural pathway in your brain, because it's been there for longer. So the most basic thing is set up from 0 to 18 months, which is trust versus mistrust. And essentially, this applies to a lot of people who do shadow and inner child work, which is given your experience in the first 18 months of your life and, you know, further on into the teenage years, your lens or filter, as we talked about earlier, for the most basic question in the world is the world a safe place? And based on whether you think the world is a safe place or not, every single other decision, thought, belief stems from that. So if you feel that, yes, I can go out and take a risk and even if it doesn't work out, nothing bad will happen to me, you can imagine that that's one life pathway. And if you think I have to fight for every single opportunity and even then I probably won't get them and life's unfair and, you know, bad things happen, that's a different life path. So that tends to be set up usually in the first year and a half of life. From 18 months to 3 years, it's about autonomy versus shame and doubt. So that's the sort of, you know, I will make it happen, I will make it work, I'll forge my own path versus the continual self-doubt. And obviously there's a lot of this work is about shame, particularly shadow work. So it's interesting to just note to yourself as we go through this, at what period of your life, at growing up, you may have experienced any neglect, abandonment, big change in your life, like moving countries or parents getting divorced or you having, you know, an illness that meant that you were hospitalized for some time. Or, you know, it may not be something as big as that, but trying to pinpoint the first time in your life that you had what's called a disruption, basically. So 3 to 5 years is about taking initiative versus feeling guilty, quite similar to the one before. 5 to 13 years is about industry versus inferiority. So hard work versus I'll never get anywhere kind of attitude. 13 to 21, so we're getting into adulthood now, the teenage years, is identity or confusion. And that kind of makes sense for the teenage years because, you know, they do tend to be quite confusing. And then this model actually goes into adulthood. So the reason that we focus on the child work is because those things are, they've been there for a long time. We may not be conscious of them at all, or certainly we'd be less conscious of them because they're deeper in our neural system. But even in adulthood, this model goes on 21 to 39 years, intimacy versus isolation, 40 to 65, generativity versus stagnation. So that's quite interesting because, you know, we were talking about can someone 45 to 65 have a more plastic brain than someone 25? And so if you let yourself stagnate, then no. But if you keep growing, then yes. And 65 and older is integrity versus despair. So basically, the idea is that these are paths that you can go down depending on what happens to you. But as Lacey said, it's all about how we dance with the environment that we're in. So although that's a good framework for understanding what can go right and what can go wrong at certain ages, neuroplasticity and epigenetics basically say that we have a lot more power to overturn that or, you know, turn to the good than we ever thought we did before.
Yeah, there's so many things I want to touch on there. And one of the first that I find to be the most interesting, because every stage that you just pointed out is so important for manifestation, and that each starts to make its way in your brain on the side of empowered. May it be safety, you know, in the first stage, autonomy. So it's so, so important. And there's a couple of ways that I want to take this, but one that's really fascinating to me anytime that I do a DI or I'm doing EMDR or anyway, journaling, sometimes I get to the root of why I'm attracting a situation or why something in my life right now, in my environment, is presenting a very similar way it has in the past, a pattern. So why I'm attracting a pattern. And each time that I do it, I tend, not always, but majority of the time, I end up actually realizing that there is an even earlier time I've experienced that pattern. And it's usually associated with, like you're saying, in one of these stages, I was in the more disempowered. You know, there's like two places you can be in. It can be an empowered or disempowered. And then I have to go and reprogram to get to an empowered place and then continue to reinforce that. That's something that I sort of want to talk about just from a science level. Patterns, I've known this. This is how I guess manifestation and science can kind of intersect in this space of manifesting and inner child and shadow. That isn't it interesting that we continue to attract patterns over and over and over again that can stem from earlier times in our lives? What would you say to that?
I mean, to be honest, that's like a huge part of how I work with my executive coaching clients, which is to try to raise from non-conscious to conscious what these patterns are. And I see that these patterns happen at work, in their personal relationships, in, you know, whatever hobby or, you know, sporting interests they've got. So I will look at a pattern that's happening across their life. And because I do a lot of financial services work, I'll look at their trading patterns as well. And I'll say that the pattern that's in your life will be showing up in your trading. And then I also do it from past to present. So it's like a cross. And if you work in that way, you can surface a pattern that's been happening all their life and now it's happening across their life as an adult. So I, again, from a very different, you know, background and way of finding it, I'm beginning to feel like I'm much more actually naturally an energetics person than I ever appreciated before, because I've found like the same patterns.
I think we all are. If we get back to being holistic, you know, like even animals who sense instinct, that's what they have to rely on. I think a lot of us have just had that stripped from us. But I think just, you know, being animals ourselves and having animal instincts, we all are energetics when we're not looking through the lens of what society tells us we have to feel, see, do, you know, that's usually quite segregated.
Completely. I mean, I had a I'll give you an example of a CEO that I was coaching, a man. And, you know, as part of the background story, I said, you know, I asked him about his sort of social situation. And he said that, you know, he'd been divorced a long time ago, he had adult daughters, and actually it was an abusive relationship where the wife was emotionally and verbally abusive. And he said, but I would never have left because of the children, but in the end she wanted a divorce. So we were talking like 20 years ago, and then, you know, I coached him for quite a few months. And then he got into a really difficult situation with the chairman of this company. And he kept saying, I'm going to find a way around this. I'm going to make it work. I'm not going to let them push me out. I'm going to stay. And I said, that sounds a lot like what you told me about your marriage. And he just had a complete epiphany and just said, it's exactly the same situation.
Yes.
Because it was something that was so long ago and in a different context, I don't think he would have put that together by himself. It's obviously so much easier to say it to somebody else. And I think I wanted to raise something from what the three of us said before about I'll always stand on the side of, you know, optimism, is that we would always do that for other people, but we don't always do it for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes it's useful to say, like, you know, what would you say to your sister or what would you say to a best friend? Because it's often a bit different to what you're saying to yourself.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And even in this current climate, you know, there's a lot that contributes to the animosity that's just going on in general through COVID and the political landscape right now, geez. And then, of course, injustice that's happening. It's really interesting because the more I speak individually, one-on-one with different people, I'm realizing that there's not a lot of nuance, right? You know, and there's a lot of pent-up emotional spectrum that isn't being released. And so it's really interesting that I think this is a really important message for most everybody right now, is that we all need a little bit more of what you just said, you know, speaking to ourselves as we would give advice to somebody we love, and looking at these different patterns that are popping up in our life. May it appear as if it's a collective pattern, you know, there certainly are those, but on an individual scale, we each have our own patterns, and we kind of have a few lenses that we can choose or that we naturally, because of where we're at right now, look through. But I think like the real empowerment comes from something like this work, and this work being licensing to go, okay, cool, this lens hasn't worked for a while. I still feel unhappy or undervalued or disempowered, or that I'm receiving injustice, or no, that I'm experiencing injustice, or whatever the spectrum might be, and that there is a possibility to do something to empower and integrate and kind of take that next step up the stairs of a new lens. And then, of course, a new environment that presents and how we perceive and interact with it. So I think that was really valuable, what you said. Definitely. Even starting with that moment, like everything I'm feeling right now, if I were to not unhealthily disassociate myself, but disassociate for a minute and perceive that I'm speaking to somebody that I love very much and giving advice, what does even that look like as a step one? And then even a step, you know, maybe it's 3, 4 for somebody starting to really do this inner child and shadow work, because to me, that was my freedom to continue to step, you know, up those stairs and walk up those stairs to the life that I desired and that I have and I continue to grow with. Yeah, so I think that's a really important, great tool and thought. And I love how you outlined those different stages of growth in life, you know, how we experience, because it does seem to me like there's kind of two ends of the coin. And obviously there's nuance in there. But it does, again, it frees us and empowers us that we can go back through neuroplasticity, through, you know, these tools, like even the ones you just mentioned, and get on the other side of the coin.
Yeah. And you've just reminded me of something that must have happened to me in a DI, and maybe I just hadn't consciously remembered, which is that I had a sort of insight about, you know, this was after inner child, that what would life look like if it had happened the way that, you know, I'd reprogrammed it. And I actually, my insight for me was that life would look actually very similar to what it actually does look like now. But I just had this overwhelming feeling where I was like, it would have just been so much easier if I didn't feel like I'd had to fight for it for the last 25 years. Do you know what I mean? Yep. So
absolutely. I have the exact same feeling. And then I do find a lot of solace in going, cool, but I would never be teaching people or sharing this with people, or if I had never been at my rock bottom so many times. So that's where, of course, you know, like kind of getting into spirituality, I really believe in my path. But I've actually had that multiple times where when I try to, even I personally am my own magnetic mom often when I'm in the deep imaginings, because I've integrated into the person that I wish had raised me. And not that my mom was bad or anything. She was just young and, you know, whatever. And it would be so curious to see what her magnetic mother would look like. But I love that insight.
But I think the hope message from that is that everybody that does your work, you know, they're going to get to that place that they want to be, that they envision. But this work can just make it easier than what you would have had to go through if you didn't meet your shadow, if you didn't heal your child. You're probably still, you know, neurologically capable of achieving those things, but it just takes more effort, even if not more time. And so I don't like the word shortcut, and I don't consider it a shortcut at all, but it's, you know, it's just like boosting that superhighway in your brain that gets you to where you want to be.
Thank you. And I fully agree as well. Jessica, I'll let you surmise that all for us.
Yeah, well, I wanted to add in one more question to just, and this might be a bit of a tangent, but when we were talking on what is that inner voice to ourselves and how are we staying optimistic for ourselves versus others, and maybe you can expand on this a bit more, Dr. Tara, but I've heard also with inner child work that one of your parental figures or caretaker figures, whatever their sort of internal dialogue to themselves, often becomes the child's internal dialogue to themselves. So let's say you had a parent that was like, oh, I look terrible in this outfit. Like, look how bad I look. Some part of the child picks that up, and now when they're looking at themselves in the mirror, they might have the, oh, I look terrible, look how I look in this dress, blah, blah, blah. What is going on there when you're sort of picking up these lack mentality, scarcity beliefs, fears in the side of distrust and disempowered from the caretaker figures?
Yeah, so I'm going to take that a step further, because you know, Lacey did ask about my former career as a psychiatrist, and actually just to be honest, from people I know as well, that the narrative wasn't always, oh, I look so terrible, and you picked that up. There's often been usually a stronger maternal narrative of, oh, you look terrible, you're not going out in that, are you? Sort of, you know, you'll never be the prettiest girl in the class. So there can be a bit of both, or a mixture, or just, you know, an extreme of one. Either way, the way that neuroplasticity works is by repetition and emotional intensity. So if it's a thing that you've heard many, many times in your childhood, whether it's against you or against the person themselves, it's still something that every time you hear something and it's reinforced, it's creating more synapses and thicker neural pathways in your brain. So that's one element of it. But if we relate this back to Erikson's stages of psychosocial development, then the caretaker is the person from whom you learn about every relationship that you're going to have in the world. Can you trust? Do you feel shame? Are you inferior? And so there's a huge amount of emotional intensity associated with one or two people that are the center of your universe when you're growing up, teaching you about how people speak to themselves or to other people in the world, because that's the only thing you can learn to expect from the whole world. So even if it wasn't necessarily directed against you in a negative way, you'll go into the world thinking, everybody thinks they look terrible. Nobody really loves themselves and feels confident and thinks that they're worth having nice things or worth taking self-care of so that they can look their best. So actually, it's a very toxic combination of the two biggest things that make an impression on a young brain, which are repetition and emotional intensity.
So then to surmise what we've all been talking about on inner child is that the idea is understanding these developmental stages of inner child, understanding how your brain was essentially formed with these thoughts and beliefs that were given to you through these stages. And then as an adult, creating repetition and emotional intensity around a new pattern and thought behavior to default to instead of the one that you have been fed essentially from childhood?
Again, just an absolutely perfect summary. One word which I really like is overwrite, because you can't really undo what's been done in the brain. You can't say, okay, I found that, you know, the reason that I don't feel worthy, and so I can unpick that. You have to overwrite it. So you did say create a new default, but the way you do that is by overwriting the old one with enough repetition and intensity that it becomes bigger than the one that you've had before. And if you think that something may have been impressed upon your brain for 18 years, then of course you might say, well, how can that be overwritten? Well, that's where the use of the binaural beats comes in, because it gets through the gateway to your subconscious, which if you were just consciously trying to say, I am worthy and I do look good in this, it would take another 18 years. But the way that the DIs are set up just accelerates that in time.
Yeah, you know, I've been practicing, just to touch on this, you know, we got a little confusion on the last episode that we had with Dr. Tara. I think somebody just heard, or maybe a few people heard her say affirmations, whereas the outline that we gave was, you know, using a DI, getting to the root memory of the trauma, the whatever, the trigger, reprogramming it, and then giving yourself, while you're down there, the very opposite saying, and I've said that many times, I just made this up, but call it conscious reinforcement. And I've been practicing that now since that conversation with how these eclipses have presented in this whole astrological warfare that's happening right now. And it's been so remarkable, because once I reprogrammed, I really got to that root. I had that aha moment, like, holy shit, this is where I picked this up, and kind of gave my brain that meal. Like, that's the thing, like, energetically, I can say sort of I gave it an appetite for this new way of eating or living or thinking or whatever. And then every time in the conscious state, when I would have that same trigger come up or a version of it or whatever, I would then, you know, and I've done this in the past, but I've never done it with such consistency. I would consciously reinforce my new saying to it, my new belief. And it has been so tremendous. And while I'm doing it, I also couple it with, because I can feel in my body where I feel, and I'll say insecurity, because mine is, I am secure. You know, I was dealing with like codependency energy, that dog paddling codependency energy. And so when I'd be re-triggered in the conscious state, say I would be like feeling codependent about this thing, I would then couple not only saying, no, I'm secure, but in my stomach where I feel the energy, I would add emotion to it, to how I feel when I'm secure. So I would actually like shift the feeling I have in my stomach to the feeling of secure while saying that. It's working so quickly. It's so great.
And that's because of the very underestimated two-way communication between the brain and the body. I'm sure in the magnetic community, people are much more aware of that. But in the sort of academic and business community, there's still quite a long way to go to understand that physical feeling in your stomach signals a secure belief in your brain, and vice versa. So it's really interesting.
Fantastic. So we're really excited to be working with Dr. Tara, just revamping the workshops with everything we've been talking about, and certainly re-looking at all of the tools we use for neuroplasticity. Yeah, just getting to the best place we can to make this the quickest, easiest, and most integrated practice that you're practicing. So exciting.
Yeah.
One last thing I want to touch on, and I know we're kind of running up on time here, but I'm sure we'll explore all of these topics in more depth in future episodes as well, especially reprogramming. But another piece of foundation is shadow work. And so shadow work really goes hand in hand with inner child, because often we pick up a lot of our shadows from those developmental stages through inner child. We define shadow as aspects of ourselves that we've rejected through pain, shame, or anything that has created low self-worth on a subconscious level. And we've disowned these aspects of ourselves and placed them in our shadow. So where does the shadow, this would be a very strange question, but where is the shadow living in our brain? Is it a repressed memory? Is it a repressed idea? Is it a conscious idea that we're trying to avoid? Like, do we see it as a danger? How, like, where is the shadow operating in our brains?
Who's going to take that first, me or Lacey?
No, that's definitely a you question. I can speak to the energetics that I think shadow is the most important thing about manifestation, but I'm going to let you take the science and real psychology approach here.
Yeah. I mean, I think shadow is, so it's physically, you know, like on a brain scan, I couldn't pinpoint to you where it actually lies in the brain. It's more of a psychotherapeutic concept. And the psychotherapist who's, I think, done the best work on this is a man called Hogan. And so because this work can be very confusing, so people can say, oh, but I really don't know what my shadow is, or, you know, people can be in big denial of it as well. I find that the best way of trying, so you have some like very good tips on the website, but it just made me think, like, because it's still a bit confronting, isn't it, to admit these things about yourself, that the easiest way to start that work is to say that you have aspects of your personality which are, you know, on a spectrum from the most, that you're the most conscious of, to down, all the way down to not conscious of at all. There are several aspects like that, good and bad. And the shadow aspects are the ones that you like least about yourself and are sort of from halfway down below your consciousness. And you know, some of them are slightly conscious, but mostly they're not very conscious. And so a way of looking at it is to look at your best qualities, so your top three best qualities, and then to look at how that quality can get exaggerated and play out when you're under a lot of stress. So an example is if you're very confident and a great public speaker, but then when you're under stress, you can become a bit boastful, you can brag, you can speak over people. That's like a simple way to start scratching the surface of shadow. The unblocked shadow work is like diving in at the deep end. I mean, I have to say, when I did it, there were actually parts of it that were really insightful, positively insightful and empowering, but there are parts of it that are almost disturbing. I think you have to really want to do that work. And I certainly did How to Manifest and then Inner Child and put shadow off until the end because, you know.
It's hard.
Yeah. I sort of felt like, well, let me build myself up to it as gently as possible. And actually, it gave me a very good insight from the neuroscience point of view, which was the order in which we do these. So, you know, I really loved How to Manifest. And then I did Inner Child and then Shadow. And I actually now think that I'd like to go and revisit How to Manifest, having completed Shadow, and be really interesting to see what's different. It was great anyway, but just to see once you've released those things, because in the brain, if there's anything that's perceived as negative or like an incomplete task, then that drains a lot of brain power, even if you're trying to focus on the positive. So although How to Manifest felt very positive and I certainly got a lot out of it, I think it'd be really interesting to see, having, you know, shed some of the concerns, how much more one can get out of it. And so that really also speaks to the point about repetition that we discussed earlier, which is these exercises aren't just done once and then you've peeled all the layers off the onion. The onion doesn't work like that. So you find more layers each time you peel off layers. So I think it's really interesting to repeat this work, to maybe go about it in a different order at some point. But those are the things that I'm really forensically looking through now so that we can guide people as well as possible on what order to do things and what to repeat and when. Basically, if you think of a line down the middle of your face, from the top of your forehead down to your chin, and on the left-hand side are the shadows, and on the right-hand side are all your most positive characteristics and your highest worth thoughts and beliefs, and then you put a line across your nose, then basically the lower left-hand side is where your shadow resides. And so this is obviously like a metaphor rather than a real piece, but it's kind of like where in your consciousness. So some things are really obvious, things that really trigger you and other people. When, you know, you say, oh, I really hate it when she does that. That is an obvious one that you may have to work on. But I think a subtler way of adding to that work is saying, okay, what are some of my best characteristics that go awry when I'm under stress?
I love that all. Oh my gosh, that's so exciting. And if there's anything that I know in my bones, is that shadow is the most important part of creating magnetism and manifestation in terms of like integrating. because, you know, when I use the word integrating, I mean that, again, we're kind of integrating into that essence of ourself deeper and deeper. And what that really looks like is letting go of shame and fears and understanding our truest potential and deservingness. That it's like that trifecta is what is magnetism. And the shadow, you know, like the beauty of inner child, just like you said, the order you went in, inner child helps you, it helps you refine who you are and heal deeply and really just have a sense of what you actually are worth and what you truly, that you're, it gives you a sense of your goodness and your truth and who you are. And shadow is like the superpower to taking anything you're experiencing. And I guess like getting back to our earlier example, anything that you are perceiving through the lens of your environment that is difficult. I mean, just like any triggering thing that's coming up, even shadow presents in the way of ways you're not able to receive compliments, or when somebody is admiring you and you can't take that in, there's a level of there's many things that could contribute to that. But it is the superpower, you know, when I always say that there's like a trifecta that's happening at the same time in order to manifest, it's unblocking, expanding, and passing tests, or, you know, being in your worth. Those three things have to be in motion to be manifesting. That's what's happening energetically. And there's an intersection of them. When it comes to the unblocking piece, if you really want a super speed manifestation, it's the shadow. And it doesn't necessarily, you know, this is, it doesn't have to be doing the entire shadow workshop, because like you said, it's really challenging and heavy. And it's honestly that designed that way in a way to really break you open. And, you know, I would love to hear your thoughts on this actually as a psychiatrist, because that could also be a little too quickly and harsh and based on what people experience. And that's why we, of course, always say, please do the side by side with a therapist if that's coming up for you. But it's to break you open. And energetically, getting back to the other point we were making, where we'll always be on the side of optimism for a person that they truly deserve the life that they want and that their soul came here. I will always err on that side, even in the face of adversity, because, and that's what shadow's essentially doing. It's like breaking that open in you, that potential that you do have that power and that you can face anything. And in fact, that you are capable of being empowered to shift this trigger that's hitting you and causing you so much pain and causing you so much resistance, that you do have that capability. So if there's one thing that I will always echo, and to myself, still practice daily, when anything triggers me, I go and look at it. You know, in that daily reprogramming exercise, I'll do the shadow and inner child integration, because I know that's where the magic lies. And I know that's where the freedom is. When I get past the, that person's making me mad, or this person, whatever, this is making me feel this way and blah, blah, blah. The true, true freedom is at the bottom of it, where it's like, oh, that's because I repress this aspect of myself, or I have shame there. And when I shift it, when I heal it, I take my power back. And then it's like nothing from that outside environment has control over my inside environment anymore. So that's just one thing I really want to give licensing to everybody listening, that it is so, so powerful. And if there's one thing in unblocking that will get you there faster, it's just recognizing when you're triggered, get to the root of the shadow and take your freedom back from it.
I love the way you said that, because I think that sometimes shame has such a big grip on us that we're afraid to do the shadow work, because we just feel that we'll be flooded with shame once we realize what a horrible person we are and how we have these sides to our personality that we really wish we didn't have. And I'll be honest, I've had therapy, coaching, everything. And when, you know, after I got divorced and my friend said to me, I think you should have some therapy, I actually said to her, if I have to go there now, I will break into a million pieces. And so I came to it at the right time for me, and it was, you know, enormously helpful. I think you're right to say quite clearly that you must go into shadow work at the right time or with a therapist by your side. But if you do it and you really surrender to it, it's actually a relief afterwards. And I really want people to know that, because I think it could be, people could be frightened to do it and really surrender to the DI for the fear of what's going to come up and how they'll feel afterwards. And I think that's why some people say, well, you know, nothing's really happening, because fear is holding them back from really, like, yes, really delving into it. But so, you know, I want to share my experience, and please say if this wasn't most people's experience, but if you actually do it and you've seen the worst of the worst, you feel so much better afterwards. It's really worth doing it. So I really want people to know that it's not something that takes you to the depths and leaves you there. It's something, it's almost like, you know, shedding a very heavy coat that you've been wearing or something.
I love that. And energetically connecting it to, you know, this other thing that I like to do, and I would love to hear your perspective on this from more of science and the brain. But one thing I like to practice when I'm in a sticky situation where I feel, you know, and as an Aquarius, I love free, I need freedom. I need freedom no matter what. But, you know, when, let's say, the walls are closing in on you. And I think everybody can identify times in their life that it feels this way. Like, we're so overwhelmed with stress, or something comes up and we're so afraid that the ground will be taken out from under us. I know that's one of my big Achilles heels. Often I will practice, let's get to the worst case scenario. What if I go to, like, the worst to face that, because then I can see my resilience from there. I see, okay, cool, this is how I can rebuild, or this is where I'll find my way out. And on a similar perspective, I also love to play, like, we have that term, I don't know if you've been through money yet, but we always encourage people to have what I call a fuck you fund before they're ready to, like, transition out of a job or whatever. Like, you know, make sure to have that 3 to 9 months of cushion that can pay all your bills. Where I'm at in my life right now, and I'm at this place where trying to have a kid and blah, 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 I'm looking at, like, my fuck you portfolio. So it's like where I just could be like, fuck it, like, dissolve everything tomorrow and move to an island or something, whatever, you yeah. know, like go to Scotland and be a farmer for the rest of my life or whatever. And so when you have a fear coming up, or you have resistance, or something's holding you back, or the walls are caving in on you, is it beneficial to do that, to look at the worst case scenario, to face it? Or I love the savior theory, where it's like the fuck you, whatever, I can always just ditch out and leave if I want. Tell us about that from a science perspective. Does that help you walk through fear? Something like shadow, if you're like, what's the worst shame I could really feel?
So I think either finding the resilience, like you said, or finding the realization that it's not actually as bad as you might think it's going to be, unless you actually go there in your mind. Both of those are very helpful, because the reason that our brain does what it does, which is basically it tries to paralyze us with fear to prevent us going into a risky situation. And that's very much for just our physical survival, not even our psychological, thriving. It's literally for physical survival.
It's like the dinosaur, yeah, running from the dinosaur.
Completely. Thing. I mean, you know, that wiring, we've talked about wiring that's in your brain from your childhood. That wiring's been there for millions of years. And although we live in a modern world where it's no longer appropriate, it's still there, and we have to make some effort to overwrite it, like we were saying earlier. And so your amygdala, where your deepest emotions come from, and your hippocampus that puts together emotion and memory, they're both in the limbic system of the brain. And that's a very intuitive, emotive sort of system in the brain and the body. And so it will react to a potential threat, which is essentially anything new, by bringing to the front of your mind all these times that, oh, well, the last time you know, went on a date and the person didn't like you, or the last time you asked for a raise and your boss fired you. So instead of staying paralyzed in that, when those memories are sort of not very conscious, if we go into those memories or, you know, an imagined scenario, then usually the fear actually dissipates, because it's there for that physical survival, and that's not actually relevant to us right now.
If we do that, if we address it, if we face it, say whatever fear is coming up for us or resistance, does that help us actually take the step we need to take?
Yeah, so absolutely. So the fear paralyzes you, then you can't take the first step. But actually walking yourself through what's the worst thing that could happen, and maybe even seeing yourself, like, become resilient from it, or realizing that it's not as bad as you thought it would be, helps you to take a small step. And then as soon as you take a step, you realize that being in limbo is actually the worst situation that you could be in. And that even if an outcome's not good, it's not as bad as your brain made you feel that it was going to be. And, oh yeah, the other thing I wanted to talk about was your FU fund. which is, you know, just a very natural way of practically saying to your brain, if the worst thing happens, I still won't be homeless. I won't, you know, I'll be able to pay my bills. I'll have some time to find, you know, a way to deal with this. So it's where your resilience comes from, the first practice, which is seeing how bad things could get. It's also nice to have in reality a bit of a cushion for if things do get bad, that it's not actually representing the worst possible things in your life.
I love that. Yeah. And from an energetic perspective, like the FU fund also gives you time. Everything in manifestation really gets back to empowered. That's sort of the theme of this, or deservingness. Both of those scenarios allow you to kind of get your gripping of empowerment back, essentially, right? You know, like if you face the worst possible scenario, and let's say you've been there before, you know that you have a way to rebuild yourself or adventure, or that you'll get out of this because you're resilient. If you haven't, that's another story. And that's something that somebody will have to experience. But on the FU fund level, that from an energetic perspective with the universe allows you to dance with it a little bit more, because, you know, in the process, you'll be tested and you'll potentially go through that magic dark and see how far you'll go. If you'll sink back to your deepest low self-worth behavior, it gives you that freedom, that dancing again, you know, and I love that. Like even in Buddhism, that's a practice to meditate on your death. Seeing the flesh go, like the full scenario of facing mortality and how much freedom and detachment essentially that can give you an embodiment. So yeah, it's just something that I just thought was interesting to bring up.
So I think the biggest takeaway that I'm sort of hearing from Shadow is when you start diving into your shadow and unblocking your shadow and healing your shadow and unearthing the bits of your shadow, it's almost like building up armor. If someone says something to me, now it's not out of left field. I've integrated that saying about me, or I've accepted that part of me is like that. Or if you start behaving in a way that's similar to, you know, maybe what you were made fun of when you were younger, or in a way that society doesn't deem acceptable, you've already addressed it on your own terms. And because it's conscious, you can work on it in a conscious way versus feeling like these things are coming at you blindsidedly and out of nowhere, and you can sort of take your power back and build your armor by uncovering them yourself first.
I would personally say that shadow for me and what I would see with clients is actually like taking off your armor, because to me, the shadow is the protector, the ego, the onion, you know, that is here to keep you safe in the world of all of the ways that you either witnessed or experienced of why you wouldn't be safe, or you're not good enough to be safe, or all of that. And in fact, just taking the mere example, let's say someone is attacking me for something, let's just say, and then it's really hitting a pain point because it's re-triggering the same way that maybe I was bullied in school or something, you know, a pattern I've received. And then I go and I look at it and I really address it and I see what they're attacking and where I picked it up from. And it really just comes from the fact that maybe one of my parents, when they were younger, were really susceptible to the same type of attacking, but they never addressed it. Therefore, I took that on. Whatever. This is a convoluted example. But long story short, when I integrate it and I go, well, I'm not that thing. I'm not void of that thing. And this actually has nothing to do with me. Not from a conscious state. I really get to see it and I really get to work through it through, say, a DI or through the entire shadow workshop. That attack no longer, you know, it may be painful in the moment, or I might feel something, but I certainly will no longer take it on and be like, that's because of me, because I'm bad or I'm shameful or I'm inferior. In fact, it'll usually reflect, like usually the point that I come to is like, oh, that's actually a representation of them once I've healed it. So it allows me to actually take off my armor, to be more integrated and therefore connect deeper with my environment, feeling safer with the people in my environment. And kind of the spinoff to that, that I think we spoke about, if you're having trouble, let's say it's difficult for you to look at your shadow or to do that work, and hopefully side by side with a professional, if it is really difficult, when you actually experience the worst case scenario of like, let's say I unravel emotionally, what will that look like? And you really, it maybe will help you take the step to doing it when you've totally gotten to see what could come out of that. You face the fear.
So then, okay. So I'll change my summary stance.
Dr. Tarr, do you want to take a stab at that?
Yeah, I want to add something before Jessica meets her final challenge for the podcast. So there's a form of psychotherapy called transactional analysis, which very simply says there's an interaction that goes on between two people above the table, like that you're both very conscious of. And there's an interaction that goes on between not necessarily your shadows, but just your subconscious self sort of under the table, as it were.
Would that be like subtext in a script or something? The unspoken?
Yes, but it's even more than that.
More unconscious.
Yeah. Basically, the best example of it is the reason that, you know, women who grew up in houses with domestic violence get attracted to aggressive men is because even if you say, you know, I'd never marry somebody like my father, in the shadow, you are that, you know, beaten up woman that expects to be treated like that. And even if somebody, you know, on the surface looks very charming, but that's in their shadow, that's why a lot of the time we get together with people that aren't right for us on the surface, but it's because our shadows are good for each other because there's the victim and the tormentor. So, you know, one of the reasons to really come to terms with your shadow is so that you can't be derailed by your shadow being attracted to something or someone that feeds it but isn't good for you.
I love that. So transactional, what is it called again?
Transactional analysis. And the best book I could recommend on it is called Games People Play by Dr. Eric Byrne.
I'm going to write that down.
You'll love it, actually.
It will be in the show notes, everyone.
Yeah. For that specific example you gave, I always call it the trauma, like the missing trauma puzzle pieces. It's like your trauma perfectly fits my trauma. You know, it's that missing puzzle piece. And that's so, so true. And I imagine that that's applicable for same sex as well, relationships that you're attracted to. It's being the, what did you call it? The abuser and the
victim. So yeah, I think I said victim and tormentor, but yeah, it's abuser and victim. And it applies to all relationships, not even necessarily just romantic relationships. It can apply to like you and your boss or friendships as well. And so there's another psychotherapeutic saying, which is you meet somebody at the highest level of your trauma. So if you haven't dealt with your shadow, you know, you will inevitably get drawn to people that are only as far as you've got with your shadow. And that's probably the biggest reason for wanting to take on that work that can be so challenging that it feels easier to avoid it. The reason to do it is that it takes you to a higher level of worth, as you've always said, but you know, that's the psychotherapy behind it.
Bam. There's the quote of the episode. Quote of the episode. And B, that surmises right there why shadow is, I would say, the most important part of unblocking. You just nailed it on the head. And that's energetically why you get so far in manifestation when you integrate and heal your shadow.
My last statement on this. So also I'm kind of seeing that, okay, so the shadow is not putting on the armor, it's removing the armor and understanding that you are safe without it.
Love it.
Done. You win.
Completely.
This was so fabulous. I am so honored to speak to both of you on this podcast. And I just have so many things I'm processing. I can't wait to go into the edit and re-listen to this episode over and over. I think this was so helpful and impactful. And I encourage everyone to probably re-listen to the episode as well, because there's so many takeaways and so many things that might be applicable at different stages throughout this year and throughout your life. So definitely listen back on the sections that feel applicable at different times. And thank you guys all for joining. And thank you, Lacey and Dr. Tara, for this amazing episode.
I've seen many people rush out and buy your book, The Source, but for those who are interested in learning more about Dr. Tara's work, as well as you have two books.
I actually have three, and this is probably speaking a bit to my shadow. So my first book was called An Attitude for Acting, because I actually really wanted to be an actress when I was at school, but my father basically said, over my dead body.
Wow, we have so many similarities. I had no idea.
I know. Yeah, because I didn't know about that about you when I first found out about you, but I did later as well. And then The second one is Neuroscience for Leadership, which is very much for like business and academic. And then the latest one is The Source. So that's, yeah, more aligned to the work that we're doing now.
So, so good. And I'm already like, I have so many sections I've pulled out of The Source that I want to cover in explained episodes too. So it'll be very exciting for future tune-ins.
Well, to be honest, Jessica, why don't you just take the book and do all the little summaries yourself and just do your own podcast?
Yes. You could have a Spark Notes or whatever. I'd read it. That's awesome.
Well, thank you guys so much. And I hope you all have a wonderful week and continue to increase the plasticity of your brains.
Thank you so much, Jessica.
Thank you both.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
Thank you so much for tuning into the episode. And I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did, we did. And in case you're not totally ready to join the pathway yet, I wanted to share a few of our free offerings that I'll often suggest to people as a little bit of a blueprint to get them started on their manifestation journey. The first place I like to direct people completely for free is The Motivation. You can see it linked below or on our homepage as our testimony library. And it's categorized by different subjects, whether you're calling in career, money, love, wellness, and much more. When you're reading about a member's experience of what they manifested, you're actually seeing to believe and showing your subconscious that that very thing is possible for you. The second place I like to direct people is to the free clarity exercise, which is also linked below. In it, you get to try our own unique hypnosis process, learn about the science, and some journaling prompts. And the best part about this, you'll get a tiny taste of what it's like to go into your hypnotic state, bring your subconscious forward, and create new neural pathways while receiving clarity. And the third thing, if you haven't listened to it on this podcast yet, please go back to the episode titled Manifestation 101, where you'll learn the basics of neural manifestation to truly understand this process. So go ahead and check out those free resources, The Motivation, the free clarity exercise, and the episode Manifestation 101, all linked below. And in an effort to make sure to have representation in this process series, go ahead and submit any process testimonials you have, especially to our LGBTQ+ community, our BIPOC, as well as the WISE, which is anyone in the community who is 45 and over. All right, we'll be back next week.